As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm joined by Mr. Tony Evans, Mr. Patrick Barkley, and from the Great Northeast, Mr. George Culkin. This week we'll be taking a special look at the Northeast of England and also discussing Arsenal and Blackburn. Well, since right around this time where we celebrate the anniversary that Sheikh Mansour and his billions came and graced English football, let's start at the Stadium of Light, Sunderland and Manchester City. It seems that every week that Manchester City don't go and win, all of a sudden it's pressure on Mancini, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, just when I thought he was out, they dragged him back in. Is that the situation right now as you read it, Tony?
I think he'll be sleeping with the fishes before long. No, I mean, it's early on in the season, and they're clearly going to be a good side before the end of the season. They've spent a lot of money. They've got good players. They're not the top rank of players, but, you know, they'll be all right. And I think they'll be in the top four this season. I don't think it's a gimme, but I think they'll just edge there.
Patty, is there really, I mean, we in the media, we play it that way, one bad result, and because of all the money he's had to spend, then it's up and down. But from the sense you get, is that how, you know, Khaldun and Gary Cook and those guys, is that how they see it? Or are they really sort of, you know, changing their opinion from one week to the next of the manager?
Well, I would think so, yes. I mean, this is the way we judge football these days. I mean, I can remember Gary Cook last season came out with sort of various 70-point targets and then fourth place and so on. And obviously they change from time to time. I mean, losing to Sunderland, I don't think is who can be one of the best home teams in the Premier League. Isn't a disaster, especially as they've just beaten Liverpool. I agree with Tony. I would say on balance that City will get it right in the second half of the season and finish in the top four, and that will be real progress.
George, you started the season Spurs away, Spurs who finished ahead of City, Liverpool at home, who they Muller, and Sunderland away, which is, as Paddy says, is sometimes a tough place to go. And of course, Sunderland away with Tevez making that sort of shock miss. Are we making too many excuses for Mr. Mancini here?
Well, you know, you look at their matchday squad yesterday, and it cost sort of upwards, you know, almost 300 million quid, I think it was. And I don't think that really leaves much room for excuses, you know, to be perfectly honest. But of course, it doesn't matter how much money you spend, you've still got the same problem that any manager has. If you buy a lot of players, it takes a bit of time to gel. And I was there yesterday, and for the first half they were very, very good. That miss accepted. Yaya Toure was immense, particularly, but they completely ran out of steam in the second half, and you know that's something that they have to get to grips with very quickly. The Premier League is very different to other leagues around the world, and it takes a sort of certain amount of physicality and stamina and endurance and all that sort of stuff, and they certainly didn't have that yesterday.
Is that an acceptable excuse, though? Because I mean, most of the starting 11 are people who played here last year, right?
Yeah, but you know, I suppose you've got someone like Toure in particular. I mean, I thought he ran the game yesterday. I mean, for the first 45 minutes, he was running through people, not around them, and was brilliant. But they couldn't, you know, Sunderland came at them in the second half, and they couldn't deal with it. I mean, there are a few new players in there, And you know, I just don't think City's approach in the transfer market leaves Mancini with much scope for excuses. I mean, it's Champions League or bust this season. It has to be.
What would you like at the back, George? Because I mean, I'm still uncertain of their best defence. I'm still uncertain he can keep goals out.
I've told you before, Tony, not to ask me technical questions. I thought largely they did all right. They did all right at the back. If you don't, really, their problem yesterday was if you don't score, you don't win, yeah. And that's what Mancini said afterwards. And with that kind of, they approached the game. They had two holding players in midfield. Only Tevez up front on his own, and it was that side of the game that I thought didn't gel really.
But the players in midfield, and thank you by the way for not going on with a stupid line that so many people seem to. Oh, he's playing three defensive midfielders when Yaya Touré is clearly not playing that position.
No.
But on Touré, it seems kind of counterintuitive to take a guy who played as a holding midfielder most of his career, sometimes at center half last season, and say I'm going to play him further forward. And also with Touré, somebody tweeted during the game, I believe it was Calkin the Times, commenting on the size of Yaya Touré's backside and how it makes Titus Bramble's look small. George, please explain.
I think I did point out in that tweet, it wasn't something I massively wanted to focus on, but it was drawing the attention a little bit like Kevin Nolan's did actually in the Champions League last season. There are certain things you just have to sort of sit back and acknowledge, yes, that is something worth, something worth pointing out. He clearly had borrowed, I think, luckily for him, I think there was a pair of Richard Dunn's XXXL shorts left around when he moved to Villa, but he is such a big bloke. I mean, he is absolutely enormous, and the idea about playing him in this sort of more offensive attacking role definitely paid dividends for the first half yesterday. So I mean, Sunderland couldn't cope with him, and he is such a. I mean, it's like watching. Who's that huge American basketball player whose name I've temporarily forgotten?
Shaquille O'Neal.
It was like watching him playing in the NBA. You know, he doesn't have to go around people; he just goes through people. Mm. And it was very impressive. But I mean, it didn't last until the end.
Let's move on. A tremendous save from the Sunderland goalkeeper, Mr. Mignolet, who I think will probably be a little bit unfamiliar to most of our listeners.
Yes.
George.
Yes, well, he's a Belgian under-21 international, arrived this summer for about $1.5 million. He's caused a little bit of concern, or his arrival has caused a little bit of concern, because he's very young, and he's deputising for Craig Gordon at the moment, the Scotland keeper who's injured. And he's certainly had a mixed introduction at Sunderland, and, there's been noises off that Steve Bruce would like to sign a more experienced goalkeeper on loan, but he's stuck by him, and he produced an absolutely wonderful save yesterday from Adebayor, point blank reaction, and hopefully that'll calm him down and settle everybody else down as well. But he looked very good. He looked very good yesterday.
George. He's quite a good keeper. Quite a good keeper who used to play up in the northeast. Who's supposed to be available on loan at the moment. You have to move quick.
Yeah, and Shea was on the bench for City yesterday. Mm. I mean, it sounds like Fulham have been sniffing around him.
Yeah.
But I think the view at Sunderland was that having gone out and spent over $1 million on Mignolet, they really had to stick by him.
Well, yes.
And Gordon should be back in a couple of weeks anyway.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, having spent £9.5 million on Craig Gordon or something like that to go and bring Shea Given on his doorstep would probably not the most politically wise thing. I wanted to ask you, because in the end, Sunderland go ahead and they win the game. Injury time penalty, I think it was, there's no question that it was a penalty. But up steps your boy Darren Bent, George, who, it's weird, for a consummate goal scorer, I don't think he could have taken that penalty any worse. And also, am I right in thinking that all the penalties he missed last year, he hit the ball weakly to the goalkeeper's left? Because it seemed to me that like Joe Hart knew that.
I think there was a bit of kind of mind games going on afterwards, because he said I spoke to him afterwards, and he said that, you know, he's taken a lot of penalties against Joe Hart in training with England, and so I think, you know, he said he knows I always go one way, so I decided not to be too precise, just to blast it, and of course he didn't blast it, but he got it in there, and there are some sort of quite interesting, if slightly alarming, stats about Darren Bennett. I mean, he scored all four of the goals scored by Sunderland players this season. Stephen Carr gave them an own goal, and he scored 50% of their league goals last season, and it's now more than a year since Sunderland won a league game in which Darren Bennett hasn't scored. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's been a brilliant start to the season with him again, but, you know, also it does show just how over-reliant they are on him. They really do, you know, they really do need another striker to back him up.
Blackburn and Arsenal. Before we get into the actual game, I want to get you, each of you guys, want to get your view on this, because when Wenger made those comments before about Blackburn's style,
yes,
I kind of went like, God, we've had this for sort of like the last 5 years, where he complains that this rough house, it's long ball, and, you know, it seemed to me like he mentioned Stoke, but you kind of knew Stoke was actually a proxy for Blackburn.
Yes.
And then, you know, Big Sam fires back, and he's got his column, and I'm just wondering, are we in the media to blame that we keep asking Wenger about this, and so he bites every time, or is Wenger pursuing a bit of an individual agenda here, and by extension, you know, Allardyce and that whole sort of Allardyce, Ferguson, Bruce gang as well.
Yes. I'll tell you exactly. I mean, he is pursuing an agenda, but it's a football agenda. It's something that we in the media should be pursuing because. And I do think this is the failure of journalism in this country, in that it doesn't identify issues in the game, such as the persistent fouling of goalkeepers at set pieces that's been going on in the English league for several years, and in fact, and other physical manifestations which are encouraged by our referees. And I mean, he's no alternative but to point it out. It's rather like the striker who's getting his shirt pulled. Is he supposed to just slow up and oblige the defender by being slowed up so much that he can't get the ball? Or eventually, after four times, is he entitled to dive? You have to look at the causes before sort of accusing people of agendas or diving or anything like that. People, unfortunately, because of the refereeing in this country, you have to draw attention to persistent failures of referees to apply the laws, and that's what Wenger did. And I just think, personally, as a journalist, I just think Wenger shouldn't have to do this.
I have to say, I think, you know, actually, Arsene Wenger was pulling off absolutely the oldest trick in the managerial book. I don't think this was a crusade, you know, a crusade for fairness in football. The referee in the match between Stoke against Tottenham that he referred to was Chris Foy, the referee who officiated between Blackburn and Arsenal a couple of days later was Chris Foy. So you know, I think the point that Wenger was very, you know, very.
But, I mean, is it an old trick? I mean, you imply that it's some kind of a trick to try to get a referee to apply the laws.
Well, it's managerial. It's managerial mind games ahead of a game that weekend to either, you know, single somebody out for praise to get inside somebody's head.
You're implying, George, that there's something wrong in that. I mean, do you honestly? Would you rather have? Are you perfectly happy to see goalkeepers being roughed up against the laws of the game?
Because absolutely not. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that it's the oldest trick in the book for managers to play mind games before matches, and that's what Wenger was doing there.
What's wrong with that?
Absolutely nothing. But I'm merely pointing out.
I think the thing with Wenger is what Wenger really wants is the opposition to be 11 dustbins that the, you know, Arsenal can pass the ball round and go and score without opposition. You know what? I think the way to combat teams like Arsenal is to be a bit physical with them. And I'm not saying, you know, you got to step outside the laws of the game. But, I mean, clearly, I think, you know, it's football is a game where the physicality is increasingly being taken out of it. And
quite right,
I,
too.
I like it.
The point is, football is not a contact sport.
Oh, it is.
If you can show me in the laws... The original laws, as they were devised by the English, most unhelpfully, did provide for a physical contact game. But gradually, over the years, the physical contact the illicit physical contact, that the first thing was hacking, which was permitted in the English laws. And an awful lot of people regret that. And it's part of the English mentality.
Sorry, can you define hacking?
Yes, hacking is kicking... kicking the legs of an opponent with no attempt to get the ball, merely in order to trammel him, to stop him from being able to proceed. Otherwise, that was institutionalised in the original laws of association football. And it seems to me that a lot of people in England rather regret their passing.
Tony, are you in favour of the return of hacking?
Well, we all have mixed feelings about it. In all seriousness, though, I think the great players are able to transcend the physical advances of the opposition, and I think as we've lost that, and you know, I mean, I don't want to see a game of ball juggling where people are just allowed to, you know, to time on the ball to do whatever they like. I mean, I think defending's a lost art, and I think we need to encourage defending.
Is a loss. Art because of infringements of the laws. Nobody, I mean, there's nothing better than a tremendous last-ditch tackle, even if it catches the man. That kind of physical contact is absolutely fine because it's within the laws of the game, and it can be very beautiful. I mean, a last-ditch tackle. We all want that. The lost art of defending is because of all the things that referees don't pick up. Shirt tugging, barging goalkeepers, pulling, pushing, use of shirt tugging, we've already talked about. All these kind of things which are routinely tolerated and which you think skills should have to rise above.
Yeah, but to be fair, Paddy, let's face it, the best strikers are masters of those dark arts as well. So, you know, it works both ways. I mean... You know, so I mean, I think we sometimes, obviously, we don't want to see crude brutality in the game. Clearly not. But I think there's a certain amount of, I think Wenger sometimes complains when really there's no case. Sometimes he has a really genuine complaint. But I, the point I'm making is Wenger, I think, would love to see the opposition stand statically still and applaud as Arsenal walk the ball into the net.
I need to bring it back to Blackburn Arsenal, but actually I find this debate fascinating. I mean, I'm going to list up the help of George here because I couldn't help but talk about Carl Henry and Joey Barton. There's no other space in the show, I think, to talk about this. At the end, they came out and said, well, look, you know, both two honest pros, they went at it hammer and tongs, blah, blah, blah. For my money, I think what they both did was dangerous, especially what Henry did. And I shudder to think I'm sticking up for Joey Barton here. George, are you okay with that when it's two guys and, you know, of their own volition, they kind of turn it into Fight Club, and as long as you don't hurt anybody else?
Well, firstly, it's... I never foresaw myself saying at the start of this season the following things. Joey Barton is not a Nazi, and Joey Barton deserves a little bit of sympathy. I mean, I wasn't there on Saturday, but from the outside, it certainly looks as though that he was targeted. I'm not saying that in some sort of conspiracy fashion, but you know that the idea was to get at him, knowing that he's got a sort of suspect temperament, and see what happens. But he actually responded by and large, pretty well. I've only seen the highlights. On the highlights, although it seemed to cause much mirth on Match of the Day, you know, I think it did verge towards the unacceptable. I think there were some pretty bad challenges going in there. I mean, I love to see a sort of midfield battle and two players going at it fairly, but I think that edged towards a sort of darker area personally.
I'm totally with you on that, and I think this is one situation where, you know, you take the referee aside if you're Riley and you say, did you actually see this stuff? And if you did see it, You know, you're out, and in fact, I'll put you in the stocks and publicly humiliate you. We are supposed to talk about Blackburn and Arsenal, but I, as I said, I thought this discussion was interesting. Let's rattle through this. Theo Walcott scores another.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
I'm Manveen Rana from This Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Great goal. Anybody care? No? Okay, let's move on. Mambaram Diouf, we put him in the baby category of signings and so on. He looks useful, right,
Patton? Yes, he does. He knows how to make a run, that's for sure. If you touched on Christopher Samba earlier, by the way, and to me, now that you see, just briefly going back to the physicality thing. Now, I love watching Christopher Samba. To me, he's a footballer. He might be huge, but he's a real footballer, and he uses his physicality fairly. You know, so I just wanted to go back to that. But Diouf, I was very impressed with. Yes, I mean, he made that. He told who was the guy who pulled the ball back for him for the goal. Anyway, he told him where to put it, and that's what good strikers do. It looks like, I hate to say it, but it looks like that awful Warlock Ferguson's done it again.
Well, I mean, you got to say, like, both Diouf's look good this weekend. You know, they can play a bit, and you know, again, it's you don't want to say nice things about El Hadj, but no. I mean, you know, the reality is Blackburn play a bit of football. In fact, they were much better. They were much better when they stopped knocking the ball long, and you know, had they attempted to play more football, maybe they would have got something more out of that game.
Moving on, we got to take advantage of the presence of one George Culkin to talk about Newcastle United and the Northeast. I have to say, I as an outsider and to this country, but somebody who's lived here a while, I always talk about, you know, I come here and people talk about the same stereotypes of Newcastle United, how what a massive club it is, even though, frankly, outside of this sceptred isle, the only people, most of us, most Europeans have, you know, the only way we've heard about Newcastle United was because of, you know, oh, look, it's the club where Paul Gascoigne started out and they spent a lot of money on Aaron Shearer. It doesn't occupy this mythical worldwide thing. But then it comes here and you've got all these fans and so on. And I kind of felt, I really missed Newcastle last season being in the top flight. So I want to start with George and get the sense is, I missed Newcastle last season. Does Mike Ashley care? And is the club still up for sale?
Well, officially the club is not up for sale, but I think unofficially you would ask most people and they would say, you know, they would say yes, but you know, as Liverpool and other clubs have shown, it's not a great time to be selling what is effectively a trophy, you know, trophy asset. And Newcastle had a whole year of that.
Whoa, trophy and Newcastle?
Good point. What happened, you know, so last season it came off the market, they're in the Championship, and although this will sound a bit sentimental, I think what did happen was quite important in the sense that the club rediscovered what the important things are, and that is, you know, winning football matches, a team which is a team, not a collection of disparate individuals, and some of the fractured relationship between pitch and stand was repaired. And I think there was a bit of sort of soul renewal going on by people going to Doncaster and Blackpool and all these places that they've not been to for a long time, and actually sort of remembering what football was all about. And they've come back up, you know, arguably a weaker squad than the one that went down, featuring people like Michael Owen and whoever else. But they've come back as a stronger team, and I think we've certainly seen that in the first three or four games of the season, and I have to say that I've been pleasantly surprised by what they've done so far.
Well, some of us actually suggested that maybe given the situation Newcastle was in, maybe, you know, the relegation could be turned into a positive, and I think it has been, and it's probably good news for Mike Ashley too, because I don't know if anybody's actually calculated what his P&L has been since relegation, but I'd imagine it hasn't been that bad, because they went down, they got the balloon payments, he didn't really spend any money, he sold a bunch of players and comes back up and still hasn't had to splash out too much, and pushes guys like Perch and Williamson, and it's a way forward without him putting money in his pocket. He realizes, hey, maybe I don't need to go.
It's strange to think of Newcastle as a well-run club, but suddenly they've become that. It's odd.
If I could sort of just interject that, I mean, I think what's happened is that they've stumbled upon a sort of solution which is, which has kind of been acceptable to everyone. So, Chris Hughton has done an absolutely brilliant job. He came into that job very much with his eyes open. He'd seen firsthand what happened to Keegan, what happened when Joe Kinnear was there, what happened with Alan Shearer, and he knew what he was getting into. At the same time, he's certainly kind of eked more out of Ashley than people would have expected. I think it's fair to say they've had two sort of good transfer windows in a row now, going back to January. They haven't lost anybody important. They haven't kind of cashed in, and they've sort of made what look to be fairly sensible, sensible additions. I mean, I don't think the problem with Mike Ashley has ever been his intentions. I think what has been the problem is the execution of those decisions. You go back to, you can make arguments for bringing in Kevin Keegan. You can make arguments for bringing in football directors. It's just the way they went about it, and some of the individuals that they appointed were kind of all wrong. But certainly the idea of bringing in younger hungry players who will have a sell on value is not a bad one, providing that they're the right players and you've got sort of good people making those decisions. I think it's wise to say, with this regime in place, sort of anything can happen, and it would be foolish to sort of get too, to get at all complacent about anything, because there's a maverick streak there certainly, but the Aston Villa result, nobody saw that coming. They went to Wolves, did very well, and Andy Carroll has obviously become has become a big talking point.
Oh, gosh. I was at a football match watching the Newcastle Villa game, and when the journalists were all, naturally agog as the game started, and when Aston Villa were given a penalty, there was a sort of grins all round, and one of the journalists said, "Let the patronising begin." And there was this sort of feeling that Newcastle were about to be slaughtered, and everyone was saying, "Oh, these fans deserve more." That was when you say that, nobody saw that result coming. When Villa were given that penalty, I honestly thought, "What are we looking at? 0-6?" And then suddenly it's 6-0. I mean, that proves A, that I know nothing about football, but B,
well. Very much likewise. But to me, the really, I mean, and this will sound like such a basic thing to say, you'll think I'm crazy, but to me, the most heartening thing about watching Newcastle last season, and indeed so far this season, is that you know that those 11 players on the pitch actually want to be there playing for Newcastle. Mm. And it's, a lot of them are the same players that went down and underachieved and, looked poor, and you kind of wondered where their careers were going to go. Mm. But going down and kind of confronting what that meant and all that uncertainty there was around the club last season, being up for sale, no permanent manager in place, Alan Shearer hanging around waiting in the wings, it has brought something out of them.
And I mean, you look at the character has emerged from from odd directions. I mean, I think we mentioned last season, George, that Nolan is marvellous captaincy. But I mean, I was watching Jonas, and I've watched him a few times, and he gives everything.
Yeah,
he gives everything for that club.
I think he was giving
everything. Because we get cynical about footballers, but I think if you look at Newcastle, there's a team with a bit of character about it.
Yeah, I think in Jonas's case, I mean, even when they went down, I don't think anybody accused him of not trying. But what I find remarkable, though, is again, is this idea, which always gets to me, is like new manager takes over, like, well, will the chairman back you? Will he give you money to spend? Will he change everything? This kind of shows, you know what?
Just get
people before spend a lot of money. Some of these guys are good. Some of them are not so good. Hey, there's a guy here. Get on with it. You know, Jose Enrique is not that bad. Coligini's not that bad. Kevin Nolan's not that bad. Make these guys work.
The value of inertia, you know what? It's when the idiots try to manage and try to be proactive. Yeah. That's what screws with them.
Newcastle has been such an unstable club over the last 3 or 4 years. It's kind of just been a relationship that's worked, because whilst as a journalist, it's been very difficult dealing with Chris Hughton because he gives absolutely nothing away. You know, we're used to Newcastle managers filling up the pages of newspapers kind of for us, and he's had the opposite effect. But as someone who, you know, who cares about football up here, he's been absolutely the right thing. He's sort of soaked up everything, deflected everything, and they've gone about their business in a kind of very effective and efficient manner. And it's most unusual from a Newcastle perspective, but also very, very welcome.
George, what I'm about to ask you about might not have actually happened. So, correct me and we'll edit this out. But I seem to remember, I had food poisoning one day last week, and I was laid up in bed, and I seem to remember...
No, that did happen.
flipping on Sky Sports News at one point and seeing Stephen Taylor hands in transfer request. Did that actually happen? And if so, what's his story here? Because I thought he was sort of, you know, hometown hero and, you know, the Geordie Steven Gerrard and so on.
It's just, that would be a strange kind of food poisoning fantasy to have, Gab. But no, it was the other way around. He was put on the transfer list by Newcastle. He's now in the last year of his contract. His agent, who is the fairly notorious Paul Stretford, has not been able to get an agreement with Newcastle. And, you know, it's part of the bluff and counter bluff that goes on at this, you know, this time of the year. He's been asking for quite a lot of money. The club have a fairly strict wage structure at the moment, and also are trying to put relegation clauses into all new contracts. So, you know, it's one of those things. He's in the last year of his contract. We all know what that means, and sticking him on the transfer list, I think, was a way of trying to call his bluff.
See, it's funny, because if Newcastle can only operate like some clubs I know in some countries I know, you could send a whole bunch of Newcastle fans round to his house and his family members and so on, and basically, you know, gently persuade him to sign at a number that suits the club. But I guess that kind of thing doesn't happen in Newcastle. Final point, what's a good season for Newcastle this year? Is it simply avoiding relegation? Is it, you know, 10 to 12?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it's avoiding relegation. That's the, you know, that was the big thing that they came into the season with. And I think after three league games, it would be foolish to sort of start recalibrating that sort of that target. I think they will have some difficult days ahead. It's just great from their perspective that they've got some momentum. You know, momentum going forward. They've shown that they can get results away from home. They've certainly shown that they're going to be tough to beat at home. But, you know, the key to this new Newcastle, if you like, is certainly stabilising this season and then building gradually from there. The last thing they need is for people to start sort of saying they're going to qualify for Europe.
Dull. We want Keegan back. We want top four in the trophy. We want that schizophrenic, manic, depressive northeast thing. Come on, George, step it up.
They've already started to revert to it. They've actually found a centre forward, a local hero.
Yeah.
I mean, they're doing all right. Don't knock them, Tony. They are conforming from quite a few.
Straight up from the pit and onto the pitch.
Still, you know, there are certainly, you know, there are hurdles ahead, because there's Andy Carroll has a Crown Court case next month. That's obviously public knowledge. And, you know, it being Newcastle, there's always, you know, there is always a banana skin around the corner. I mean, you have to say that. But whilst this kind of coalition holds, it's been kind of pleasing. It's been pleasing to watch. But you know, I think they do need to do the dull thing for a little while. You know, they've had a season and a bit of it, and it served them very well. But what they, you know, certainly what they want to be doing is kind of building gradually out of the spotlight.
George, don't let these guys wind you up. Newcastle does not exist solely for the amusement of people elsewhere. Okay, time now for everybody's favorite segment of the show, some quick hits. I'll be asking the questions. If you guys run long or I get bored, I will ring this bell. Like
right, okay, we've got that.
Manchester United roll to a 3-0 win over West Ham. Rooney scores his first goal since March, albeit on a penalty. Paddy, is the hoodoo over?
Yes. I mean, class is permanent. The Rooney thing was only a fitness calm World Cup kind of cumulative crisis. He'll be fine now.
I'm totally with you on that, and encouragingly, he also played well. Chelsea scoring average drops as Stoke hold them to a 2-0 win. George, is there now a crisis at Stamford Bridge? And on a more serious note, from your vantage point in the Northeast, what chinks do you spot in Chelsea's armour?
Well, the fact that they're not scoring for 6 goals every week, obviously. Well, hang on a second. I mean, you know, a couple of weeks ago, they hadn't won a game in pre-season. People were saying they were too old, that there's no way they're going to win the title. And, you know, now complaining about their goal average dropping. No, some games are more straightforward than others. Playing Stoke at home, you know you're going to be in for a physical battle, and they showed it. That they can handle that perfectly well on Saturday.
Not a bad week for Liverpool. Tony, so many exciting things going on. What excites you the most? Beating West Brom 1-0? Torres scoring again? Spending $10 million on Raul Meirelles? Spending $4 million on Paul Konchinski? Or seeing the back of Javier Mascherano?
I think I'm going to be sick. Not a bad week. It's a pretty crap week. Liverpool were awful against West Brom. West Brom could have been 3-0 up at half time. The players they brought in of a class that at one time would be laughed out of Anfield. And Mascherano, well, he wasn't my favourite player, but he was sold at a price which was too cheap. And it's symptomatic of the mess that is behind the scenes and in the boardroom at Anfield. Ring your bell.
And Gillette and Hicks are still there, of course. England's qualifying campaign begins on Friday. Plenty of injuries from Terry to Ferdinand to Lampard. Yeah, the Ferdinand one, I think we kind of got familiar with by now. But no space for Joey Cole or Aaron Lennon, for that matter. Paddy, is heartache ahead for Mr. Capello?
Well, there are good signs in the sparkling firm form of Walcott, which makes Lennon's absence not quite such a shame. Also, on the centre-half crisis, the most important thing is that England aren't having to face, what's his name, from Manchester United, Dimitar Berbatov, who's in magnificent form. So the Bulgaria game, everything hinges on that. If anything goes wrong in that, they then have to go 3 days later to Switzerland, and that's a really tough game. So ask me Friday night.
Will do. Wigan allow 10 in their first two games, then go and win 1-0 away to Spurs. George, were we all a bit harsh on Wigan, or are Spurs simply not very good?
Well, I think this is what Sir Alex Ferguson would call a football bloody hell moment, surely. This is why we turn up to stadiums week in, week out. You know, so on the off chance we can see one of these results. I think there's a bit of both in what you say. You know, Wigan had a huge amount to prove, not only from the start of the season, but also what happened at Spurs. Last season, Spurs were a bit of the, after the Lord's Mayor, oh God, can I say any more football cliches? I do apologise. Bit of both, move on.
At the end of the day, it's only a cliche.
To be fair, actually, I thought Wigan played really, really well, and I thought Tottenham were just terrible. Everton fall at Villa 1-0 and are now in the relegation zone. Obviously, it's way early, but Tony, you're completely impartial when it comes to Everton. Wasn't this the year when Everton were supposed to kick on to the next level?
Nah, it's the customary David Moyes bad start. He'll be talking about resigning by October, and then we'll be talking about his manager of the year because they finished ninth in May.
I've got a question for you, Gab. Zlatan Ibrahimovic has left Barca for Milan, who will take him on loan for a year and then pay $24 million. to buy him outright next season. It sounds to me like Barcelona have lost a tremendous amount on this deal. So who benefits in the long run?
Well, Zlatan Ibrahimovic actually also lost a tremendous amount on this deal. He took a 33% pay cut, which over the next 4 years means he leaves in excess of 20 million on the table. You know what? This was kind of like basically a very expensive divorce, you know, where it can be very, very painful and extremely expensive and everybody loses out. But in the long run, you hope it avoids you more heartache. As for AC Milan, I think they're kind of laughing all the way to the bank on this one, given the prices involved. You want more? Go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find all the latest news and gossip and the latest on the transfer window, which shuts down in just a few hours. And also our web chats. I do one. Ollie Kay does one. And Gary Jacob will be doing one as well. As well as Mike Atherton, if you're more of the cricket mentality and you can talk all about cheating and corruption and all that nastiness. But we do want to hear from you. It's gamepodcast@timesonline.co.uk. Till next week.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no,
I don't,
yes.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.